Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and joined again, though not in Las Vegas, by Mark Christensen. How are you, Mark?
Hey, Mike. Great, and it's great to see you come all the way from the other side of the world out to Las Vegas.
It was fun with Ron, back out from behind the shroud of his book, back in the real world again. It was good having the three of us together last week.
I liked it a lot. I really like having a room full of folks listening in when we do them, too.
The live audience. So we're recording this one not in the same room, but we are this week looking at the film Spider Week. And Mark, I jokingly refer to this film as Jumanji with fairies.
Yeah, I think that's a very incisive three-word criticism of this film, Mike. I hadn't thought about Jumanji in quite a long time.
It just seemed to me that instead of a board game and be warned, it was a book, and there was just a succession of weird characters and a lot of visual effects and, you know, kids running around and the odd adult that doesn't believe them, and finally the whole thing's put back to rest, and by the end of the film we're back to normal again.
Yeah.
Sorry, I don't know which film I was talking about then. Anyway, so let's start off by saying this was primarily an ILM film, and while I love anything ILM does, I will fess up and say I wasn't actually busting a beat to get and see this film. This wasn't really sort of my film. But having said that, anything with ILM and Tibbett and stuff doing the effects is worth seeing.
Yeah, I agree. They're two of my local houses here in San Francisco, and you know, the screening I went to, I think, well, it may not be that everyone in the audience was from ILM and Tippett, but it sure seemed like it.
Now, so let me just say that this film has been out for a little while in the States, hasn't it?
Yeah, in fact, when I speak about having seen the screening, that was back in wintertime. I'm reaching a little bit to remember clear details about it. You're at a distinct advantage.
Yeah, I saw it last night, and in fact, it's coming out on DVD June 24th in the States. And I actually think this is a film that people will get on DVD rather than going to the cinema. I don't think it had a mega box office. Not that that's the yardstick of quality, but I definitely think it's going to be a DVD kind of film.
Yeah, I agree. It definitely seemed like it's aimed at the 10-year-old viewer. I heard from 10-year-olds who liked it.
Actually, the thing that I found interesting was that there was a sort of a negative publicity thing that was happening with people saying, it's too scary to take little kids. And then my feeling was, well, if it's too scary for little kids, older kids may not buy into the whole fairy thing. And maybe that's just an inherent problem in the material.
Yeah, it could be. I did seem pretty soft in terms of how really scary it was. I think they were going for goofy and comical some of the time, although not exactly broadly comical. I think Jumanji, I think you hit it with that. I think that's about where they were aiming.
Huh. Well, here's the thing. Look, we're going to comment about the film, as always, just to make this sort of, you know, we say this every once in a while, but we can criticize things in the film, having had not worked on the film, having no understanding of why something the way it was. I mean, I might criticize something that the animator, you know, was sort of responsible for, but they were directed to do that in a certain way, and it was all up to somebody other than them. And that makes it harsh, because one hates to criticize fellow artists in any way, shape, or form. Not that I want to just lay into anyone, but it's just that we are speaking just from a reviewer's point of view, not from insider knowledge point of view. So I guess from that point of view, we can now be what do you call it in America? Half-time quarterbacks, is that right? Or full-time quarterbacks? Or
Monday morning.
That's it, Monday morning quarterbacks. I knew there was a quarterback in there somewhere. So let's discuss what you thought of the visual effects and not the film itself. And how would you sort of rate the quality of the work overall?
Well, I mean, I can look at it through several different lenses. There's a character design way of looking at it. There's just the compositing and effects look at it. And then, of course, there's animation. I think that I saw a lot of good work just in the classic visual effects compositing type of stuff and learning more about the film. I actually have a lot of respect for how much experience they brought to even when they shot it, and the number of things they kind of saw and headed off at the pass. I think this is a you know, it's a really experienced crew at ILM that took this on, and they knew what they were doing.
Well, a couple of stats. I think there's about 500 shots in the film, of which about 341 were ILM shots, and they had a couple of hundred artists working on those, and that was about 30 minutes of screen time. Tippett Studios did a bulk of the remaining work, and then there were a few other houses that contributed. It's interesting that you talked about... you really just nailed my whole opinion in point form then, because I thought the compositing was excellent. I thought the quality of the 3D, while good, there were some animation aspects that I didn't like the direction they'd gone in. I don't think it was bad animation. I just didn't think it was appropriately what I was expecting to see. But one thing I thought was interesting was just how good the compositing was. And Pablo Hellman was one of the visual effects supervisors from ILM. And do you know him, Mark?
I know him by reputation.
Because I think he's not as well known maybe as like a, mm-hmm. you know, John Knowles or somebody. But I think he's outstanding. I mean, whenever I see his stuff or his name on a film, it's almost now moved to that, you know, I'll go and see the film just to see his work. I think he joined ILM in about 96, but the reason I brought this up, he actually came through the Sabre department, which of course was Flame. So things mm-hmm. like Saving Private Ryan and I'll go back to Men in Black and all that kind of stuff. And then became a supervisor and did stuff. I think he was still in the Sabre for around Star Wars Ep 1, but then I moved to being, you know, his stuff on some of the later stuff, like, you know, I think by Ep 2 or 3, he was a full-fledged supervisor on the film. And I just think he's got an eye and he just nails it.
Yeah, I would agree. There was not a lot I could really flaw in this film, either about the comping or about even things that had to be done to support the comping, like all the physical planning that went into making the twin gag.
I was going to say, the twin gag, I tried not to read about the film before I went and saw it, and I didn't even realize they were twins. I literally walked out of the cinema going, man, that was good casting. That guy's got to be that guy's brother, because he looked just like him.
That's high praise.
And... you know what? I mean, now looking back, maybe I could have tweaked to a couple of sort of shots, but generally the flow of the camera work didn't change when they hit the split screen shots, and that's normally the giveaway.
Yeah.
You know, the whole camera motion just falls down.
No, I had the feeling they didn't give those guys a break at all. They pretty much just shot it the way they wanted to, and if anything, the only person they were trying to give a break to was it Freddie Highmore, the actor? I mean, he's pretty young kid to be pulling off something that technical as acting with himself. It trips up a lot of kids who have to try to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen obviously that gag done a lot of times, and mm-hmm. our friend Jeff actually way back in the day did that with one of those it wasn't a Freaky Friday, but it was one of those, you know, kids movies where the kid is sent off to summer camp and finds their twin brother kind of thing. And I mean, all those shots tend to suffer from having to constrain the camera work to sell the shots. And I'm thinking back now of stuff in the car when there were obviously the double was there were two kids in the car and just a bunch of other action scenes. And I just didn't feel like the camera suddenly froze and became less fluid or more like a motion control shot.
No.
So that for me was like the absolute highlight, and Paulo's work is just outstanding. I don't know him personally, but I just as you say, by reputation, he's I think he deserves a fair hunk more recognition because I think he's a rock star. But the one that didn't work for me was actually I think from Tippett Studios, which was The Goblins. Now, here's my thing: these guys were short, squatty, evil, blobby characters that I felt we never really got to see their faces that well. I never got to see any real menace other than they were just sort of like giant puppets moving very quickly on the screen. But more importantly than that, they just didn't have any weight. They just mm-hmm. seemed to be sort of, not that it wasn't tracked in properly, but it was just that they were just flitting around the screen like they were lean animals that could move quickly, like the sort of greyhounds, but yet they were, you know, looked more like the physical dimensions of a tortoise. And the two just didn't add up for me. I just, I don't know. What did you think?
Well, did you think there was also something about just the way maybe they were directed? Sometimes their action seemed like they were sort of extras in a Gilbert and Sullivan musical or something. Like, they weren't really meant to be...
Keystone Cops.
Yeah, I mean, they weren't really meant to be menacing, clearly. And anytime you go for, you know, it's an actor's problem when you're supposed to be goofy, because, of course, it's no one's intention to act goofy. Some people and creatures just are. And so anytime you see characters acting goofy, it's a problem in that way. And I don't I don't know if I'm nailing it here or not for you, but
Look, I think I could have done Goofy if they'd had momentum and physical weight and that they'd been clumsy. But, you know, look, okay, so what am I to that I don't know what a goblin looks like, right? Well, I don't. The only thing I can go for is what I know in the real world. And under real world physics, which isn't obviously goblin world, nothing moves like that fast, that quickly, and that light-footed, that's that short, stumpy, and, you know what I mean? Like, it's the same problem I had with the Hulk jumping and skipping his way through the daisies in the Hulk first film, right? Like, anything that big and heavy shouldn't be able to skip and jump miles in the air, because anything big and heavy doesn't do that. Yeah, now, I mean, it's obviously a weird criticism to criticize a fake creature that way, but, you know, I just looked at
them. Yeah, I mean, there's almost a dramatic expectation problem here, too, because they did try to set these guys up, you know, they... And yet, you get the feeling that you're meant to go be seeing the movie so you can see all these creatures from this really cool illustrated book. Like, they're not dramatically presented in a way that creates any anticipation or...
Well, I didn't think there was any character in this film that was Golden Compass or... Well, let's use the example of Yoda. Yoda in the Star Wars films was a supporting actor. Like, the character animation gave that character incredible depth acting wise, right? Like, you'd, and it wouldn't have to be a big scene, right? They'd just have an emotional shift from here I am to I'm about to pick a fight to don't screw with me. And you were like rooting for the character, and it was just, you saw it in their eyes and in their face. And I never felt I had the screen time on those characters to get that kind of emotional connection to them. Like, I didn't feel I was rooting for any of the digital characters to follow their story. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I'll go out on a limb, and this may prove your point, but I thought the most successful creatures were actually the sylphs, the little flower fairies, which are meant to be floaty and not really meant to have a clear, sharp character. And I just, I think, though, I really liked the way they looked shot in macro. Like, I just thought they looked really pretty. And I,
that's something you, I also noticed, amazing use of depth of field. So, now, speaking positively, I thought the film used depth of field on the digital stuff really, really well. Like, it seemed that things were going in and out of focus a lot. They were hitting shallow depth of field. I really felt like they nailed it in terms of the optical characteristics, both in the compositing and in the, you know, whatever technique they were using to do the blurring. Yep. And I agree, those characters were really successful, and I liked those characters, especially when they met the aunt on the balcony of her nursing home. That was just, you know, really beautiful stuff. But, yeah, you know, the bad guys, just, you know, one more monster jumping around after somebody. And I know it's a kid's film, but still, it's like, would it be that much? You know, like, when things are bedded down a bit, you don't need to be quite so flamboyant. Like, you don't think things to be so wild if they're based more in the real. I mean, using a live action example, one of the most violent films I ever saw was a thing called Once We Were Warriors, right? And Once We Were Warriors, one character, I think the main character guy, basically just hits a wall at one stage, right? But the emotional tension in the film made it incredibly violent, even though there wasn't actually a lot of body counts or people actually being killed, right?
Yeah,
just great acting. But when you get great acting, when you get great camera work, you get great direction, you don't need a lot to add to the tension and the, you know, but when you start getting comical, then you have to go incredibly far to get the same kind of emotional impact.
I wonder if this is a danger sign for studios that fall in love with projects, because, you know, on the surface, this is Tippett Studio, which is, you know, that's a house really dedicated to doing creature work. And this was a, you know, it began almost as a labor of love in-house. They started doing shots for it before they'd even gotten the go-ahead, you know, that they had the project.
But isn't it like every studio wants their own Narnia? Every studio wants their own, you know, sequel, kids, makes money, we can roll them out, Harry Potter franchise?
Cynically, yeah. But, I mean, this was driven by the artists who I think just really loved the books. What did you think of the character design itself? I mean, did you think it undermined the animation and the weight?
Look, I thought that the main, you know, Mulgrath, if I pronounced that correctly, the guy, was great. Really good. Loved some of his metamorphoses. You know, the kind of almost tree branches of coming out of his back stuff was good. I could have probably had a bit more Nick Nolte, because he did have some real weight to him.
Yeah.
But I didn't like the Goblin character design at all. I thought that was just Keystone, as you say, Keystone Cops and naff, and not that endearing. And then I guess after that, even the winged, what was the, you know, half, what was the name of the thing that they flew off on?
That thing seemed freeze. Like it had no chance of really flying.
The Griffin, right?
Yeah.
Byron. Yeah, that's it. Byron, technically excellent, you know, really good hair and feathers. Loved mm-hmm. the rendering of the performance of the feathers. Didn't like the actual performance of the character or its character design for, as you say, having any belief that the wingspan would work. And the trouble is, we've seen good, you know, dragons. The problem with any character like that, right, is that in the real world, there is no character that has six limbs like that. You know, I mean, you've got insects that have multiple limbs, but there's no, you know, six-limbed mammals, effectively, right? So you're taking things that aren't necessarily working together. Now, and that's always the case with dragon films, because dragons have the same problem, four legs, two wings. Mm-hmm. And yet we've seen some really good, I mean, really good solutions to that problems in terms of, you know, folding wings and, you know, believing that it has the weight to be able to pull it off. But it's just that a land-based predator has a dense bone structure with explosive short-term speed, which comes from very dense musculature, and a flying animal like a bird or whatever just doesn't have beefy legs and has hollow bones and has like a much lighter frame for aerodynamics. And
yeah, and this character fundamentally looks like a bird. It looks like a bird with a, you know, beast's body kind of coming out the back of it. And so you're right, the bones need to be hollow and light for it to support that look.
Yeah, and you know, a furry, feathery, heavy downed thing just doesn't seem like it's going to have a chance of it flying, yet alone flying three other people on its back. So now the ground that it flew over, the matte paintings, the different seasons of different environments, I love those.
Yeah,
you know, loved the right. insect attacky thingies and the particle systems. All thought that was great, right? Just thought, you know. And also Byron could have been, because he's meant to be a pet, right? Like he doesn't have to be Dino from the Flintstones, but he could be endearing, right?
Yeah. Wait, who did you say, Byron? Are we talking? Is it Thimbletack, that the dude who, the moody guy? Or
Thimbletack's the guy that changes.
Boggart.
That changes.
Were you talking about Boggart?
I'm talking about
Boggart to Thimbletack to Boggart.
No, actually, I was talking about the flying guy, right?
Oh, right, I got you.
Which is meant to be a pet, right? Like, the whole idea was the flying guy was his pet, and they called his pet, and they got a lift across the great matte paintings. And
Spiderwick's pet.
Yeah, exactly. And
I follow you.
You're back on Thimbletack, who was, I believe, more of a like house elf than a pet. But now I'm really crossing my genres. you know, somebody's listening to this, it's a complete fan of Spiderwick. And at the moment, they're hitting their head against the table going, I'm going to commit suicide. but I'm not coming at this loving, you know, I'm not coming at this to see a documentary that does a 3D visualization of characters from a storybook. I'm coming at this like I came at Narnia, you know. I saw the film, then I started reading all the books to my daughters.
Yeah. It's a really crucial point, too, because I actually think Golden Compass suffered from this as well, where the filmmakers, you know, didn't lack love for the source material, but you have to win the audience over to it as opposed to kind of assuming they're right there with you. This one felt like that, didn't it?
Yeah, it felt like we're going to be true to them. It's the source material, and that alone will make it a winner, which, because, you know, that's what they did in Lord of the Rings, right? We'll just make it absolutely what the book said, and everyone will love it to death. But
that's what they seemed to do.
But there's a lot more to it than that, right? I mean, there was real depth to the performances of the characters. And this is my thing, right? Like, to really be enchanted with the magical world, they should be enchanting characters, and I should feel that I care what happens to them. And if some character's entire family has been killed by the bad guy, my heart should be going out to them rather than thinking, you know, that guy just can't leap from branch to branch like that without, you know, either affecting the branch in terms of weight or just being wrong.
It has to be said, the dramatic action, even in the purely live action sections of this film, didn't work that strongly. I mean, perhaps if you're a 10-year-old, and I'm not slighting 10-year-olds by saying that, but the subplot of parents who are divorcing, you know, that's a topic that could have a lot of weight. And in this film, it felt pretty tacked on. Like, you had to remind yourself, like, oh, right, the kids are going through all this, you know, trouble in their family. But,
well, here's the other thing, right? The thing for me is the book, right? You've got the guidebook to solving magical stuff, right? So if you wanted to make this film really sing and not be Jumanji, they'd go to the book to solve problems. And the brother, the one that was, you know, left behind, would suddenly have read some stuff that at the crucial moment he sort of does from nowhere, and everyone's like kind of surprised that, wow, you know, and that that would be inventive. But I mean, apart from tomato sauce and honey, they hardly used this incredibly valuable secret to the universe that was worth dying over book. It's like, if you read the darn thing, you know, I mean, isn't that the Sorcerer's Apprentice thing? You've got the book, right? Use it. And even if they used it and they'd backfired, wouldn't that be funny? I mean, it's just, I don't know, it just felt like you've got the code book, use the codes rather than just climbing all over the house trying to get away from the monster. It would have been fun if they'd inventively, you know, taken things from the book and used them, and, you know, had shown that they really had read the darn thing and that it really was valuable. At the moment, I feel like the book had a recipe for doing a circle around a house, some tomato sauce and honey recipes, and that was about it. So, I'm sorry.
And a heck of a lot of sentimentality holding it all together.
I'm sorry, I'm being harsh. But having said that, seamless compositing.
Yeah. All right. So, Mike, what else do we have to... what else is... What other business do we have to attend to on this one?
I think that's kind of it. I mean, I don't want to... I don't know. I think... You know, again, as I said at the beginning, if we criticize some of this stuff, we try not to have a go at the individual artists who are working in a framework of stuff. And it wasn't just the two houses we mentioned, Gentle Giant, Halion. I think Kerner Optical did some stuff. So there's quite a few people that did it. But I mean, let's face it, the film was like a $90 million kind of budget, right? So it wasn't, you know, a killer, mega budget film. But I don't know. I just fear that I'm going to be sitting here doing the review of Spiderwick 2, The Return of Spiderwick, and you know, that's not working for me. But hey, nice cinematography, and I think that's about it, really.
Yep.
Also, the other thing I think is that sound design. I just want to put a flag up there. Like, if you watch this reel at SIDGRAPH without the audio, it wouldn't have worked half as well.
Oh, interesting point. I had not taken note of that. Where did you notice it the most?
There were a couple of places where there was stuff going on, and I just remember at the time thinking that's good audio off, like it was, you know, the I think it was sort of when they were escaping the first time through the shed and stuff, and then down through the tunnels underneath and stuff. It's just, it's important to get that happening because you're in a dark cave and running and stuff, and you've got menace coming from behind you, but you want to hear it and feel it, and you need to hear it to feel it, if that makes sense. I guess we just don't give the audio guys enough credit sometimes.
No, I mean, how could we ever? And it's always such a pleasant surprise when, you know, the bacon is saved by the soundtrack coming in, especially trailers, you know, the big scramble to get shots ready for the trailer, and then suddenly there's a soundtrack with it. It's like, oh, wow.
Well, that's about it for this week. The VFX show, by the way, is produced by Pixel Call, and our producers, Kevin Hansen, Kirstine Martin, and we actually joined this week by Laurie Althop. And Laurie actually joins us as a producer, Mark, and I don't know if you've seen, but she's actually behind Artsake, nothing to do with anything podcast. But if you're into art, this is just completely left field. I was really pleasantly surprised when I discovered this podcast. And so she's joining the team here at VFX Show. So we welcome her and thank all our producers for their contribution. We've been recording this from Sydney and from, where are you?
San Francisco.
And this show... we'll go out with some show notes. And by the way, I looked at the show notes from last time, which not only were good, but stumbled across the fact that two of the VFX shows are in the top 10 downloads of the week in the general kind of mix of Pixel Core stuff. So that's good. I think Jumper and our stereoscopic one have gone well. So we appreciate you guys listening in and supporting the show. And certainly I got a lot of feedback in NAB that people enjoyed the show. So thanks for that. Mark, thank you for taking time out.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Mike, for reminding me about this film that I saw such a long time ago.
Is there anything you'd like to plug? How can people find you?
I don't need to plug anything. People have been pinging me on Facebook, which is great. A lot of great things come from Facebook. A bunch of people remembered my birthday last week because of it. And by the way, Mike, I believe we're coming up on yours this week.
It is, in fact, my birthday tomorrow. So. It is true. And
have a very happy birthday.
I'm not a Facebook guy that much. I'm a Twitter guy. I've been using Twitter to post minute-to-minute visual effects stuff that... And I know that you're on Twitter, but refusing to use it until you get your new iPhone.
You know, not having an iPhone at NAB, I have to say it was like missing a limb. I really like I couldn't participate in a lot of the fun. I mean, I was lugging my laptop around trying to keep up, and it was pathetic.
Actually, I must admit, I got Stu a good one on Twitter. We were leaving. We're driving out of Vegas. And Stu from the orphanage, who... he's a good friend of yours, Mark, and I know that we saw him at the super meet and stuff. But anyway, Stu tends to Twitter, I think you'd agree, semi-cryptic remarks at times.
Yeah, but that's all part of it, right?
Okay, so he tweets this remark, at Vegas airport, fat guy paying slots, goodbye Vegas. And so Jeff and I are driving across the desert, but I still Twitter, at airport, dorky, tall, geeky guy staring at me while we play slots. Goodbye, Vegas. But generally, I try not to waste time on Twitter, but it is a good place for posting what's happening, especially when we're doing a lot of production work. Anyway, so I'm Mike Seymour on Twitter, if you want to follow the twit thing. And, of course, I'm at fxguide.com with my partners, Jeff and John, who of course, we were hanging with in Vegas with you, Mark.
Yes, it was great. And by the way, I did want to put out there, I do realize that I could Twitter via SMS. It just,
it's not the
same. I got to get an iPhone. I'm just waiting for this new iPhone to come out.
Hey, so tell me about it. I have an American one. I have to get an Australian one when they come out here, hopefully 3G. But look, it's been great.
Do they have the
great
capitals on the right, left side or something? What's the difference?
Yeah, go with the Australian jokes. Go on. I will talk to you later, Mark, and I can agree what our next film is. But until then, I'm Mike Seymour, and on behalf of myself and the entire team at Pixel Core, thanks for listening. Goodbye.